When our community is in need, the Portage Health Foundation is here to answer the call. In 2018, we were here on the front lines helping homeowners get their lives back. And now with the COVID-19 pandemic, we're right here with the many nonprofits who help serve our community. We've provided funding to Senior Meals, Keweenaw Family Resource Center, and 31 Backpacks. We launched a Wi-Fi hotspot network to help families stay connected, and we have much more planned. If you want to donate to help our community's recovery, visit phfgive.org/COVID-19 or call 523-5920.
Welcome to segment one of Copper Country Today. On another Sunday morning, I'm Todd Van Dyke, and we continue our look at the candidates who are running in contested races in the upcoming August primary. August 4th is the date for the primary. There are three Democrats running in the 110th State House District race for the right to take on Greg Markkinen, the Republican, in the November election. We talked with Janet Metza back on May 31st. If you missed that program, it is archived on our website at QNRReport.com. Now I have a chance to talk with another of those candidates. Lawrence Dale joins me. Lawrence is from the Ironwood area. Lawrence, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you very much, Todd. I appreciate this.
You are from Ironwood, but I read a little bit about your family history. It traces back to Skaney.
Oh, yeah. My great-grandfather homesteaded out there in the 1880s, as near as I can figure. I did see in the Lawrence paper, they usually do a historical front page from the past.
I love that.
At least they used to. Yeah. And there he was on a chart that showed the business losses for the 1896 fire that destroyed Lawrence. And he also owned the Palace Saloon, so that explains a lot about our family, too. All the alcoholism in our family is just astronomical.
Oh, dear.
Totally bad.
Is that really something you want to talk about as you're running for office here?
Well, it's just that you have obstacles in life you have to overcome, and including racism, which was very big in my family. And I feel I've done a good job doing that. And improving myself and moving beyond what the family has to offer. So, I like everybody, well, like most working people, I live month to month, and I don't have a silver spoon in my mouth. I use the GI Bill of Rights to get my education, and I got my undergraduate degree in government from Ohio University. Went on, well, after I discovered at Ohio University, where I majored in government, I discovered the labor movement and the history of organized labor in this country. And I thought, you know what? I'd like to be a part of that. And so I went on to get my graduate degree in industrial and labor relations, learned about labor markets, labor law, and prepped myself as best I could to really be somebody who could help working people. And that's been the focus. And I did that for many years, representing folks even through the unemployment insurance division, where they have adjudications on whether or not you are eligible for unemployment. And I help people get their unemployment compensation. I've helped save people's jobs. I've also been a lead in the collective bargaining efforts to help working families, lead in arbitrations, unfair labor practices through labor boards, state, federal, and national labor boards. So I have a good background, and I'm very proud of it. Since the early 90s, I came up to visit family up here in the UP, looked into our family history. My mother was born up in Skaney. I was born down in Dearborn. So that's a little bit about my background. And right now, I'm an insurance broker, primarily Medicare supplement plans, and annuities. So I think that's a good product for people who are looking to safely place their retirement savings so they are not subject to market volatility. And that's primarily why I got into that end of it for insurance purposes.
Now, I have to ask you, you recently ran for the U.S. Congress in Wisconsin?
Yeah, Wisconsin is a lot different. I lived in Wisconsin for 12 years. I moved down. Well, I was living in Bruce Crossing, and I got a job selling radio ads and got tired of the commute. So I moved to Wisconsin in 06, and the radio ad business doesn't work well when you don't get any snow in wintertime. And so I went back to my other business, and a lot of folks may remember me. I used to sell meat products, home delivery, throughout the Western UP for many years. And so I did run for Congress down there, and only to find out that they would not endorse. I mean, they had the person that they wanted to endorse already set. And in Michigan, it's a lot different. In Michigan, when you run for an office, the party doesn't endorse anybody. So all the candidates that are going to that will be on the ballot are candidates that have to do it on their own to win the vote and not have an intervener like a party coming in and say, well, we endorse this guy before the people get a chance to vote. So it really hurt my campaign. And I ended up mainly stressing the danger of, well, that was the 7th district in Wisconsin, but there's a big encroachment going on now with industrial dairy farms. And these things are just notorious for poisoning groundwater, for the runoff being so environmentally destructive that we now see algae blooms in Lake Michigan. So, and as far as the dairy farming and the farmers in general, they're being knocked off and out of business by the oversupply created by these industrial dairy farms. They milk like 3 times a day, whereas your other farmers, your small dairy farm operators, only do it 2 times a day. But hell, they work 7 days a week, and they're very efficient. Their products are a higher quality than industrial dairy farms because they don't use all the antibiotics. So I felt if I was going to get traction in this election after getting what I felt to be a bad deal on the part of the Wisconsin Democratic Party, so I decided to let's dig into this. Why are we losing so many farms? Because in Wisconsin, like in Michigan, many of your rural communities are dependent upon that money generated in their local economies by the farmers. And so anyway, I didn't do well there. It was a real mess, but I think I was able to get the message out about the plight of the farmers, and the plight really was created by the state government in Wisconsin. If you look at their assembly, which is what we call our state legislature, and their state senate, they were actually promoting public policies that enhanced and expanded industrial dairy farms at the expense of small dairy farm operators who were literally being pushed out of business by state policy as determined by the Republican-dominated state assembly down there and Senate. So I think that's wrong, and the environmental damage it's doing to the Great Lakes is something I stress in my website, which is lawrencedale.org. I hope people go look at it. So I moved to Ironwood back to Michigan a couple years ago. So that's the story behind the story on why I was running in the Wisconsin congressional district.
All right. I've been very curious about that. Every candidate I have ever talked to for statewide office has agendas that they want to take with them. They have things that they want to accomplish. They have programs that they want to promote. This is probably the most difficult situation I've ever seen Michigan state government in, and I've been covering state government since the mid-70s. The COVID-19 pandemic is going to cost the state billions and billions and billions of dollars. There are going to have to be significant cutbacks in state budget over the next several years to try to catch up with the declining tax revenues and other revenues for the state. How do you think the state needs to move to address this shortfall that is going to run into the billions?
Yeah, that's an important question, and it's really a conflicting one, because 3 months ago I would have been offering up a different campaign entirely and a different kind of resolution to the problem. But right now we're looking at the only model we have, and that would be the period between 1929 and 1932, where big business said, look, let's wait it out, and things will get better, the markets will recover, and even economists today, if they will tell you that this is something, this economic collapse we're experiencing is something that's going to go on for several years. So what I'm proposing, and it's on my website as well, is that we look to the state government as the employer of last resort. It's not sustainable to continue giving people unemployment checks. People need jobs, and we need to put people back to work. and, of course, provide for occupationally specific protective equipment as well as distancing where that can be achieved.
But the state is looking at a huge financial deficit. Where's this money going to come from?
Right. Well, where did it come from back in the 1930s? We had to reimpose that 91% tax on the wealthy. They are the ones that bailed us out, and they were the ones that had to pay for Social Security. We didn't have Social Security back in 1930. But by 1932, we had passed that bill so that everybody that was 65 and over would be eligible and, in fact, be have payments for Social Security benefits, so that the elderly weren't just kicked out or left under a bridge or whatever they did back in those days. The other thing is we also had the Work Progress Administration, and we had the Civilian Conservation Corps. The idea is if you're going to revive the economy, you have to have trickle up, not trickle down. Trickle down doesn't work. And if we're going to resolve the crisis of the state, we're going to have to make sure that those who have the money pay their fair share. And I don't think that until, I guess it was in the 1970s, the corporate tax rate was still 91%. Now, Jeff Bezos, for example, just since this crisis began, has generated $500 billion in profits. Where's that money going to go? Is that going to go to third world countries to invest and create more jobs over there? I mean, that's what they've been doing, either hoarding the money or been investing it in low-wage countries, and we've had enough of that. I don't think there's any turning back on this. We shouldn't be looking at going back, just like the Black Lives Matter movement has been saying. We can't go back to the old way. This is a new epoch. This is a new era. We have to go forward. And we have to get the money from those who have it. And you have to ask yourself, where did they get it from? Well, we've totally deindustrialized, except for maybe 14% of manufacturing has been sent overseas, costing millions of good-paying union jobs. And so those people who made big money by doing that and totally undermining the blue-collar workers' ability to sustain or ever have a middle-class style living has been utterly destroyed in this country. And I think that's has been the attraction to the Trump movement. And this is dangerous. And so that's where the money's going to have to come from. Where else is the money? I mean, they keep giving trillions of dollars right now out of the Fed to prop up, the wealthy corporations. That is not sustainable either.
But the CCC and the WPA, those were federal projects. They were never run by the state of Michigan. The state, of course, can do what it wants, I suppose, with corporate tax rates, but it can't jack up the high-end personal tax rate unless you're going to float a constitutional amendment through.
Well, they're going to have to get the money. I think it's going to be a combination of federal and state to put people back to work. I mean, you have to generate demand. You cannot be relying on subsidies that are not based on people working. It's just not sustainable. And we're going to be stuck in this thing for far too long if we continue just to prop up the financial sector and prop up by just providing unemployment insurance to people sitting at home. We have to have a jobs program. We have to get the infrastructure of this state, the roads, the bridges, the new schools, dams. There's all kinds of projects that need to be done that have been put off for years that are undermining our economy's ability to survive anyway. So we need to start after that now and make those that have the money pay their fair share and still not undermine their ability to sustain their lifestyle.
Talking with Lawrence Dale, he is one of three Democratic candidates running in the August primary for the opportunity to face Republican Greg Markkinen for the 110th State House seat in the November election. The other Democrats that are running, Janet Metza, as I mentioned, we interviewed her on our May 31st program, Casey Verburkmos, whom we will be interviewing sometime in the very near future, and looking at your website, you are very, very forthright about your health care position. You believe that Michigan should take the lead and institute its own universal health care system. Who's going to pay for that?
The people who have the money. Our tax rate is so low on the wealthy that they've been able not only to get away with offshoring our production facilities over the past 30, 40 years, but also to keep that money rolling in through residuals coming forward from that investment.
But do you really think that you can pass a constitutional amendment that would institute that would allow Michigan to institute a graduated tax? Because at the moment, Michigan can't institute a graduated personal income tax. It's unconstitutional.
All right. So if we can, you know, that's why we elect leadership to go into the state legislature and get things moving. We're not going to, just because that's an impediment doesn't mean the entire society has to suffer. So I think it's important to understand that people need to get out and vote, that there are impediments to fair play in this country. There always have been, but it doesn't, we're in a democracy and, you know, so far. And that's a whole nother issue that needs to be addressed. How do we sustain our own democracy given the backlash and the move towards authoritarianism that the Republicans, including Markin and his cohorts, are moving us in that direction? So I would say that what I want to do with my program is to introduce the idea of making the Western UP and other rural districts throughout the state more self-sufficient. That is, right now, we're an agricultural area, and we're importing over 90% of our foodstuffs from the factory farm mode of production. It doesn't make sense that we don't have farmers here in this district providing a substantial portion of our basic food needs. The Western UP raises some of the best eating animals, for example, red and black Angus cattle, English bloodline cattle. Buyers from all over the upper Midwest come to Paulding, you know, every year to their auction to buy these feeder calves. So we need to get together, and I'm setting up meetings with county commissioners so that we can discuss this issue of joining together and coming up with a slaughter plant meat processing and direct marketing ability in our region so that we can create more small farm businesses and provide more for having food self-sufficiency. So this kind of thing is badly needed. Also, we need broadband up here. We know that there's grants available for that kind of thing, but the first thing we need to do in both cases is the feasibility study. And these things can run into the thousands of dollars, but they feasibility studies are reimbursable through the USDA Rural Development. So I don't see why anything should keep us at least looking into the matter and coming up with a plan to help create more prosperity in our region and more economic diversity. So this is my focus in my campaign, although there's a lot of other really important issues. But I think we can diversify the economy, create more jobs. That would be a start. And this isn't something that's over the head of a state legislator. These are programs already available. And the fact is, nobody's come up with a plan that would convince, say, the boards of commissioners to sign on. So anyway, back to your question about a constitutional amendment and all that kind of thing, we will do what needs to be done, because the way we're going now, if you're assuming that this virus is going to linger around possibly for years, and that the recovery from this economic collapse that we're experiencing is going to go on for years, then we have to begin thinking about a new way of running the state. And if that means overcoming certain limitations that don't allow us to fairly collect the kinds of taxes we need from the wealthy to institute these programs, then we're going to have to find a way around that. And I'm a person who would look in that direction. We can no longer look to the tax base for these remedies. The money's just not there among working people.
We have just a minute or two left. I want to hit real quickly the point that you raised earlier about the Black Lives Matter situation. That's something that the state is going to have to deal with. There have been some proposals rolled out this week to help try to address, at least begin to try to address that. Real quickly, what specific steps should the state be taking right now to assure that all people are treated fairly and equally by law enforcement?
Well, one thing that I proposed to the Democratic Party, in fact, to the some of them anyway, is that one of the things that I don't see that should be on the list is the psychological profiling. We have to weed out people who have a propensity towards this kind of behavior. There's people who join the police force, in fact, and I'm not saying it's an overwhelming amount, but there's a number, there's enough of them that we're having 1,000 people killed, black people killed every year by police. And this is alarming. And the racism that's embedded in this, of course, stems from the community. I mean, they're basically heavily patrolling and arresting and confronting black citizens in inner cities. So we see a higher spike because of that, also due to poverty, also due to the fact that we don't have a living minimum wage in this state, which we have to do. We are not seeing this kind of problem in Europe. Okay, they don't have mass unemployment. They have been able to quell the rise of fascists that we're seeing. We're seeing that kind of rise happening here in this country. But I think if we look back to the police and we do a good psychological profile on their entry, and then if we have warning signs that come forth from that evaluation done by an independent third party, people who know about psychological testing and measuring, and we see problems, I think then it needs to be further, like the FBI, go into the family, go into the friendships of these people who have scored in a questionable way with regard to how they would handle themselves.
And we do have to wrap things up there, I'm afraid, Lawrence, because we're running out of time here, and I appreciate your time. I want to mention, too, as we close out segment one, that towards the end of the program, we're going to be instituting a new series that will run for a few weeks, co-produced by ourselves and the Portage Health Foundation, about addictions. So that'll be coming up as well. And once again, Lawrence Dale, candidate for the 110th State House Democratic nomination, thank you for your time on Copper Country Today.
Thanks a lot, Todd.
The Portage Health Foundation is a proud sponsor of Copper Country Today. This legendary weekly radio program has gone on for decades and has helped listeners dive into important issues here in Michigan's Keweenaw Peninsula. Now, more than ever, we need this kind of in-depth local storytelling in our world. That's why we're happy to help take it to the next level by sponsoring the radio show's debut as a podcast. You can find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Simply search Copper Country Today. Learn more about Portage Health Foundation by visiting phfgive.org.
Welcome back to the second segment of Copper Country Today. I'm Todd Van Dyke. Happy Father's Day. I don't think I've said that so far this morning, but happy Father's Day to all the dads who are listening to the program and all the dads across the Copper Country. We are brought to you by the Portage Health Foundation, which is beginning this morning a 13-part series on addiction here in the Copper Country. It's a fascinating series, and I know that you will enjoy it. Our first segment on that will be coming up in just a few minutes as we close out the program this morning. Right now, I welcome in the director of the Portage Health Foundation, Kevin Storr. We're going to talk about some other things that the Portage Health Foundation is up to. Kevin, good morning. Thank you for coming in.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
The Portage Health Foundation has been doing a fair number of innovative things since this COVID-19 situation began. Of course, it's been a challenge for the community. You guys stepped up big time when the flood was a big challenge a couple of years ago. Now we have another challenge. Let's start by talking about a fund that you established to help out basically those who kind of slip through the cracks on the other types of assistance that are being offered.
Yeah, you know, I'll back up a second. The fund itself was established because when the COVID pandemic first became more of a local reality, we had a number of our partners or donors contact us and ask if there's a way that they could give and how would that be facilitated. So again, for those folks that wanted to make some form of a contribution to relief efforts or whatnot, that fund functioned as a conduit for the monies to come in. And again, 100% of those monies that have come in have been expended towards recovery efforts already. And so that fund continues to this day. It's still open, and we are still requesting or accepting donations to that.
Before we get ahead of this, how do people contribute?
Easiest way is to go to our website at phfgive.org. And if there's a banner heading on there that says COVID Relief Fund, just click on that. It directs you right into our online portal for online payment. Or if you would like to make a check contribution, you can mail that to our address. Again, you can find that on our website. It's 400 Quincy Street in Hancock. So the site itself is all self-contained and very, very easily navigated to make those contributions online. And the thing that we would tell, your listeners is that, again, 100% of any contributions coming into the Community COVID Relief Fund, 100% of those monies will go to actual relief. None of it stays at the foundation.
Yeah, because your overhead costs come out of the other funds that are managed by the foundation.
Exactly. So what we've done in other cases, just like we did with the flood, we did not incorporate any of the administration or overhead. So all of the monies, the $2 million plus that we put back in the flood, and the $950,000 that came in individual and corporate donations, 100% of that money all went right back into actual homes that were part of the flood recovery, and no different here. As well as some of the other funds that we have, we've started seeing more development of our donor contributions through the form of some name foundation or name scholarships. We've actually secured a couple of large bequests this past year. You don't do much with those until, hopefully it'll be a while before we do anything with them. But we're starting to see much more activity because people are seeing that the work that the foundation is doing across, all the different initiatives that we work towards, and are recognizing that this is a very good way for them to be able to enact the things that are valuable and important to them, the types of need that they see in the community. The foundation provides a portal or a conduit for them to achieve that charitable mission that they would like to see happen, and we're happy to help them do that.
Because your foundation, you existed before the sale of Portage Health. But it was a relatively small foundation at that point, and then the proceeds that came in from the sale of the old Portage Health organization, that really beefed up the money that you had to work with, but you're not limited to that. You can bring in money from other donors.
And you're right. So the distinguishing piece there, when we existed as a hospital foundation, it was a supporting foundation to the hospital because the hospital was a nonprofit entity. So when we transitioned and took the proceeds from the sale of the hospital, we converted to a public charitable foundation that serves the larger community. And that main portfolio or corpus of funds serves the health initiatives. But we are able to work with individual donors on specific things that they have an interest in or are passionate about, and we're able to work with those donors to help create the model or the construct the method for their charitable contributions to do work in our community. So we're not restricted just to our portfolio, which is also something we're doing a little bit different than most of what we're technically called as a health conversion foundation. Most will simply have their portfolio funds and they'll live off the earnings of that and redivest those earnings back into programs or grants within the community. And we've taken a little bit more, I think, a transformative approach to how we not only grant back to the community, but some of the direct programming that we're starting to do, as well as some of the other funds that we're developing with our donor community to expand the resources that we have to make some change and some real healthy change within our community. So,
do all of those other funds and such you're bringing in, do they all still follow the same basic goal of the Portage Health Foundation to assist in the health and the wellness of the community?
Absolutely. Certainly as a foundation, we want to make sure that that we're aligning with that our mission aligns to some extent with the mission of our donors and the purpose of our donors, and if it's something that we don't believe that we can adequately fulfill for them, Then we have other funding partners like the Keweenaw Community Foundation, or if it's more of a regional UP base, we might refer them to the Superior Health Foundation. Our goal at the Portage Health Foundation is to make sure that our donor community is served and advised as best as we can. And if we can't support them directly, then we're going to find a partner that can.
Now, Kevin, you said that there have been some donations received into this COVID-19 relief fund and that money has been spent. What have you used it for?
You know, one of the things that we started doing immediately was convening weekly calls with many of our community partners and community stakeholders from throughout the four counties. And then we've also brought in other funding partners from throughout the UP and throughout the state to participate in a conversation. And the way that we introduced it to this convening was we want these calls to be solution-focused calls on how we are individually as an organization responding to COVID, or how collectively we can come together as a community to effectively scale the limited resources that we do have to address the need that is immediately present, as well as what we can anticipate coming out of this COVID pandemic. So, you know, some of the things that we started in the very beginning, obviously, there was a huge need for personal protective equipment, mainly masks, some gloves, some face shields, hand sanitizer. So we did immediately acquire some of that type of resources and distributed it out to a large number of our community partners. For example, we distributed about 2,000 masks to our community partners. Little Brothers is an example, as their volunteers were going out to the homes and doing elder checks and whatnot, or senior sure. meals. We wanted to make sure that not only their volunteers or staff were protected, but also to make sure that our elder community saw that the people that were coming to them were taking the necessary precautions.
Well, and that elder community, that's the community that's most at risk.
Oh, absolutely. And not just at risk from the virus itself, but also the social isolation and that lack of community connectivity. So we wanted to make sure that all parties involved in that exchange were protected and the perception of protection was there. We also provided several thousand dollars to 31 Backpacks and the Ontonagon County Backpack Program for emergency meals for the students that are in need. We've provided some additional relief. One example that's coming to my mind right now as we're talking was the supply pantry. A lot of it is diapers and wipes and things like that at Keweenaw Family Resources, that we provided some additional resources for them to replenish that supply. Again, serving young families that are maybe a little bit more in need than others.
And those things that you can't buy with a bridge card.
Exactly. And as we've done this, I'm a very visual person, so I have my grease boards, or in some cases, my windows are all markered up. But what we did is we identified some of those immediate long-term or short-term needs that existed, again, in concert with our community partners, and we were able to identify the things that we could come in as a supportive role to help our community partners be better prepared to meet the need that existed within their sector. But then we also started looking at some of the longer-term initiatives that needed to take place. So when we start talking about that, another thing that kept coming up was the lack of connectivity. Wi-Fi connectivity was a real issue that kept coming up. Whether you were talking to Mr. Staccaro at the ISD about the number of families and, you know, the range of disconnectivity of the student base and teacher base based off their residence.
Sure, that was a major issue that came up when they started talking about continuing education at home, is that not everybody has access to broadband service, not every family can afford broadband service, and all of a sudden they were going to count on this to educate our kids.
Education, access to health care for some of our, you know, especially if you have more of a chronic illness that you're trying to access.
Well, and you're right, particularly because they've been doing a lot of online medicine
exactly.
over the last few yep. weeks because of this.
Yep, telehealth. So what happened with that whole thing, Todd, is we actually were contacted. Glenn Anderson reached out to us and just said, you know, is this an issue we've heard from a few of our constituents about in the community, the challenge of connectivity or digital inequity. And, you know, is this something that we could take a look at? So we started having that conversation with some of our community partners. And, you know, this whole idea of creating, we certainly can't at this point create an overlaying cloak that provides Wi-Fi for the entire community. There's a lot of challenges that exist, including topography and lack of infrastructure for our ISP providers and whatnot. But what we were able to do is we started imagining, you know, some Wi-Fi hotspots, some drive-ins. And I reached out to Corey Anau, who's the, I believe, the president of Berga Telephone Company and UP.net. They were immediately responsive to the idea because they themselves had been talking about how do we look at creating, you know, increased access for our community, not just their customer base, but the community at large.
They're good people. We've worked with them as a radio station for years.
Yeah, they you know, Corey is just like, yeah, we can do that. We're willing to sit down with his accent. He's like, we're willing to sit down with you and have this conversation. And again, you know, I go back a lot of times. You'll hear me say this in many of our conversations. You know, we really try to do some root cause analysis on the issues that we face, but we really try to keep those conversations solution focused. Because if we get lost in the weeds on all the things we can't do, we start overlooking some of the small steps we can do. So in this particular case, we worked out with UP.net and Berga Telephone Company and their partner, Peninsula Fiber Network, PFN, out of Marquette. And we sat down and we said, you know, what can we do? What can we reasonably do in a relatively short time to get our toes in the water and provide some access? And we identified about 36 spots, you know, trying to create these isolating some spots that people won't necessarily have to drive 20 miles to access. And we tried to look at that radius, and we identified a number of locations, and we went through and we talked to some of the other either business partners or other customers or some of the facility owners. And we have been in now actively launching Wi-Fi drive-in hotspots throughout our regional community. And we have about, as of yesterday, I believe we had 16 out of the almost 36 locations identified up and running. We went into this... I can tell you, we went into a blind. I did not have any type of utilization metric that we would have in mind that would say this is successful. And I think unofficially, I was thinking if we saw 4 or 5 connections at, say, a Tapiola site out by Kurt's Corners, there's that little service hut that Berga Telephone has. That's a Wi-Fi hotspot. I was thinking, well, if we had 4 or 5 a day, that's going to be exceptional. As of Wednesday, we were seeing anywhere from 90 to 150 connections per day at those various
sites. And word on this has barely gotten out.
Exactly. So,
this is the first in-depth discussion I've had about it. I knew it was in process, but
we're some of those may be reconnections. But what we are seeing is the sites are being utilized. And what's exciting to me, and I can tell you, we would have never ventured into this. This was not, if it would not have been COVID related, and we were not looking at the lack of connectivity and the digital equity absence, the disparities that exist as it relates to education, access to education, which is one of our long-term goals, access to healthcare, which is one of our long-term goals, we would have never looked at this as an initiative for the foundation. But because we have, and because we're seeing this response, you know, I had shared with my board in the very beginning, one of the reasons that we've done this is I'm really hoping that this will serve as a platform to have a larger conversation about the disparities that exist. And this ties right back into another program that we're bringing to our community, a Bridges Out of Poverty program that's going to start in July. But the disparities that exist within our homes that not only affect their young person's access to education, people's access to working from home online, the social connections and communication, but also what does that do in terms of our local economic development? When people are building homes, and one of the questions they ask is an internet streaming service available if I'm going to build in this location? It's becoming more of a demanded utility like water and electricity is. It's a significant part of our economic development, and I'm hoping that this will bring awareness to the disparities that exist and create a larger conversation that we can, as a community, come together and start having that conversation.
Talking with Kevin Storr, he's the director of the Portage Health Foundation. You have been making some moves in regards to making sure that food arrives in the Copper Country to folks who need it. You've had a couple of challenges.
We have. This is a little bit of maybe a little bit early to talk about, but I'm sure Mike and Dr. Michelle will forgive me for this. You know, we identified in the very beginning some of the challenges that were going to be present because of joblessness, increased unemployment. You know, we had originally were concerned a little bit about some of our fresh food supplies as we were, you know, as everybody was watching dairy farmers dumping milk and produce farmers tilling their fields and whatnot. But one of the things that we've been really happy about and very, very grateful for, Jean up at Western Michigan UP Food Bank and the Community Action Agency has been working with us on additional food distributions, and we've been able to help facilitate a larger conversation again between the food bank, us as an intermediary, and Feeding America.
Yeah, the national organization that the local group is affiliated with.
Exactly. And we are working right now on bringing in some additional food distribution trucks that would otherwise not have been available. So here again, if somebody is looking at what we're doing with our COVID response, we are budgeted right now about $60,000 in expense. We're looking at bringing in three cycles of trucks. There'll be four trucks per cycle. We're looking at beginning in August. We are still working through the schedule and the memorandum of agreement with Feeding America, and that's why I say this is maybe a little bit early, maybe a preface. But we are working to bring that additional food throughout our four county area. So we'll be looking at two additional trucks on three different occasions in Houghton and Keweenaw, you know, for Houghton and Keweenaw County, one for Berga County, and one for Ontonagon County, for a total of 12 trucks. We're projecting about 180,000 pounds of food that we're going to be bringing into the community this summer.
That I know is badly needed.
Yeah.
We're about to start that first segment of the addiction series that the Portage Health Foundation has put together, and it's going to be continuing for the next 13 weeks as part of Copper Country Today. I don't want to, it will speak for itself in terms of topic, but why did you decide that a series like this was necessary?
This actually started, we're probably about almost 18, 20 months into this project. And, you know, our former communication director wanted to do a series that would help break down the stigma that exists around addiction. And this series and the videos that you'll see really, in our mind, had a couple different purposes. One was to begin localizing addiction and helping to break down the idea that this is someone else's problem. And then the other part that was really important for us and goes hand in hand with that is the stigma associated with alcoholism, substance use disorder. You know, we talk about heroin, methamphetamine, marijuana usage and whatnot. Marijuana that's laced with fentanyl and whatnot. I mean, it's a different dynamic today, and we wanted to have a local conversation about addiction, and how, what does it mean for our community? What are some of the things that our partners are doing about it, and how can we as a community just come together with awareness and understanding it, and just being a better. Maybe being a better listener, but also being a better participant in this conversation of an issue that affects virtually everyone here.
And you said changing that stigma that's attached. I did a couple of Copper Country Today programs several months ago, one on the Ripple Recovery House in Launce with folks from there, and one on the Needle Exchange program that was started here in the Houghton and Hancock area. And the things that I learned that researchers have learned about addiction in the past few years really changed my view about this. And I owe a great debt to the people who were on the program talking to me that I now see addiction as a much different problem than I thought that it was. I thought it was a moral issue more than anything else. It turns out it's a physical issue, and that's something that I think we're going to learn a lot about in this series that begins in just a moment or so.
Dr. Frimidig does a really nice job discussing some of the health facets of addiction. And, you know, a simple exercise, as your listeners are tuning into this program, you know, I could ask them to, you know, think about how many, you know, do they know somebody that has addiction? Raise your hand. Or how many of you lost?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very connective issue, and we're looking forward to helping, again, bring that conversation to the community.
Well, we will hear the first segment of that series in just a moment as Copper Country Today continues. Kevin Storr from the Portage Health Foundation, thank you. And again, if you want to help out the Portage Health Foundation in their efforts, phfgive.org is the website. Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you.
Addiction is typically a taboo subject to discuss in detail, but as we're about to find out, the issue is a very real one in Michigan's Keweenaw Peninsula. I'm Sarah Blakely, morning news co-anchor at TV6 News. Over the next 13 episodes of the Portage Health Foundation's addiction series, we'll talk about what addiction is, how it happens, and the effects that it has on a person, their family and friends, and the community as a whole. We'll also talk about what's already being done to address the issue and offer solutions for people who are struggling or know someone who is. We'll also help you better understand what you can do to help. In this first episode, we'll hear from the Executive Director of the Portage Health Foundation, Kevin Storr, and the Chairperson for the Foundation, Bernadette Yeoman-Olette. We'll also hear from Rebecca Crane, the Executive Director at Dial Help, who will tell us how this problem has evolved over the last decade.
Employers, you know, manufacturing companies that are trying to get, you know, trying to hire employees. I had one that I spoke with that, you know, he said it takes 6 or 7 employees for every hire to pass a drug test in our community. The financial implications that addiction has on our community is actually quite overwhelming when you consider, you know, the access to healthcare, the court systems, law enforcement, the burden that it places, the financial burden that it places on our nonprofit community to try to serve our mental health community. Virtually all aspects of our community are impacted by this. And, you know, I think it's important for people to recognize that this isn't somebody else's problem. This isn't another community's problem. It's not, you know, a downstate problem or somewhere else in our country's problem. This is a problem that's affecting us right here. And it's not that, oh, that's not my kid syndrome, because maybe it isn't their child, but it might be your child's best friend, or it might be your neighbor. You know, and I think that's an important piece to recognize, that the folks here need to recognize in this community that we have a real issue and it is impacting their lives, whether or not they recognize it. It's impacting virtually all aspects of our community.
I think people have to understand that addiction now kills more people than auto accidents and gun homicides combined in this country. I think rural, being in a rural situation, we're not immune to the problem. Per capita, we have higher rates of addiction than urban areas. So we can't hide behind this issue anymore. We have to face it. We have to confront it. We have to work together as a community to address it. And until we do that, it's only going to continue to expand in our community and take much more of a toll on our community, both economically and that human toll that I mentioned.
In 2017, the calendar year, we had over 1,500 calls just related to substance abuse or alcohol. For us, that's about 25% of our call volume. In terms of mental health, it's 45%. And again, there might be some overlaps where those issues didn't independently come up, but we know that they're tied together. And unfortunately, too, with those two issues, I know I'm elaborating, but our percentage for suicide calls rose again this year. Now it's at like 13%. When I started, it was around 2 to 3%. The problem we know is only getting deeper. And, you know, it's disheartening when you have 5 overdoses and 3 of them resulted in death, and they're all in their early 20s. And recently we've seen where young children are dying because their parents are addicted and not trying to harm their children, but not able to care for them, and some really significant tragedies. I think really the community has to come together, and not just service provider agencies. I think everybody needs to have a more of a role together. Otherwise, I feel like it's only going to escalate over time, and those tragedies and suffering and misery are only going to start piling up more and more.
Thank you to Kevin, Bernadette, and Rebecca for sharing your experiences on this issue. We hope you found the first of 13 episodes of the Portage Health Foundation's addiction series to be enlightening. This series is available as a video and audio series on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, IGTV, and wherever you listen to podcasts. Just search for Portage Health Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, know that there are resources available in our community. Dial Help is a great place to start. They have a crisis line 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, based right here in the Copper Country. Just dial 906-482-HELP, text 906-35-NEEDS, or chat live with someone at dialhelp.org. If you're in any kind of medical emergency, dial 911 immediately. To learn more about the resources available in our community or to subscribe for email alerts for future episodes, just visit phfgive.org/addiction.
When our community is in need, the Portage Health Foundation is here to answer the call. In 2018, we were here on the front lines helping homeowners get their lives back. And now with the COVID-19 pandemic, we're right here with the many nonprofits who help serve our community. We've provided funding to Senior Meals, Keweenaw Family Resource Center, and 31 Backpacks. We launched a Wi-Fi hotspot network to help families stay connected, and we have much more planned. If you want to donate to help our community's recovery, visit phfgive.org/COVID-19 or call 523-5920.
I hope you enjoyed this morning's Copper Country Today. Thanks to our guests, Lawrence Dale, candidate for the Democratic 110th House nomination, and Kevin Storr from the Portage Health Foundation. Our series on addiction in the Keweenaw will continue next Sunday. Copper Country Today is heard each Sunday morning at 7 o'clock on 97.7 The Wolf, 8 o'clock on 99.3 The Lift, and 9 o'clock on KBAR 102. You can also listen to our podcast at KeweenawReport.com or at iTunes, Spotify, or iHeartRadio. If you have a topic you think we should cover, email your suggestion to kreport@up.net. I'm Todd Van Dyke. Copper Country Today is brought to you by the Portage Health Foundation. Learn more about them and their mission at phfgive.org. This is a copyrighted public affairs production of Houghton Community Broadcasting.